Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 33, Gather Round the Fire with Women and the Rabble. Then on the eve of Samhain precisely, Mungin dies. So this is the death of Mungin the Banshee. Hence Samhain is called by the rabble Mungin's Feast, for she was a witch and had magical power while she was in the flesh. Wherefore, women and the rabble make petitions to her on Samhain. Ah, what a remarkable set of lines. They're the last lines of a story in a chapter called The Death of Crichan, etc., in the Silva Gadelica, a collection of medieval Irish tales translated by Standish O'Grady around 1892. I'm dropping them here at the start of the journey we'll take together in this episode. We'll work our way back to this ending and imagine a new story on the other side. I think we have much to discuss about what these women and these rabble-rousers were doing and why on this Samhain-tide feast in honor of the Banshee, the witch, the queen, the goddess, who was known by the name Mungin. But first, let's find ourselves in this moment, upon this very sacred point in the Celtic wheel of the year. Because right now we are deep into Samhain season, and it really is more of a season than a single day. Though Halloween is often considered the modern equivalent, and Samhain is associated with October 31st, it's a portal through time. Much perhaps like the portal tombs that were there, built by the mysterious ancients long before the Celtic ancestors would have rooted their own communities and practices and worship around them. Last night, my family and I had our own fire. It happened to be All Souls Day, that day to remember the faithful departed in the Christian calendar. Catholicism is rooted deep in the bones of both my own family and my husband's. And our ancestors tend to use the language of the church calendar, if not the actual Mass, to reach out to us. Early in the evening, my daughter spent a long time memorializing her dearly departed fish, a series of bettas who were so beautiful and so fragile, and who were so important to a few years of her young life. The best fish had been named Samhain because we had brought him home from the pet store on a full moon night in late October. And then, once the sun set and she refused to put on more clothes to be comfortable by the fire, my husband and I sat there alone, just the two of us. And inevitably and unexpectedly, we began remembering those who'd left. Our parents' deaths, our lost aunts and uncles, the way the family had worked so very differently for the good and not always so good when they were all around. We slipped into a sort of informal ritual space, just the two of us by the bonfire, conjuring memory and, in our own way, casting petitions into the flames, a woman and a member of the rabble. We cast them into the flames and up to the stars and over to the deer who rustled the leaves far beyond the edges of the lawn. We were casting petitions for our daughters, for our descendants, and for our own shared but always uncertain future. Last week, I brought you a conversation with Robert Mulhall about what it means to step through the Samhain portal and what it means to live our myths in a conscious way. How we walk our myths into the land and how the land informs us, how we make ritual and ceremony and symbol an intentional part of our lives. I'm reminding myself now that ceremony and ritual might look like actions and words we've learned from wise teachers. It might look like a deliberate set of practices like casting the circle and calling in support with a set of certain holy phrases. But it might also look like setting aside time to step outside of time. Even if there's a muted iPad on one of the chairs, because the Bills were playing the Chiefs and the only New York team that plays football matters. But, you know, the games matter too across time. They did for our most distant ancestors with the hurley sticks, right? And they certainly mattered to the family members that my husband and I were remembering deep into the evening. Okay, so Samhain clearly takes me down lots of different rabbit holes. Maybe they're the holes of a shape-shifting hare. These are the dark places that we so rarely give ourselves time and space to explore. And while I really do mean to tell you a story from mythology in this episode, I think this is all part of acknowledging that myth work is always about weaving the imagined past and the might-be future with what we can know of our right now. So with those opening lines about the women and the rabble making their petitions on Samhain, I'm bringing you back to the founding myth of this particular podcast. I'm reintroducing you to Knotwork's matron goddess. If you're a longtime listener, you've heard me mention Mungin many times. She's the forgotten goddess queen witch who came to me as I tended another fire back on the autumn equinox of 2021. And she came through to me while I was sitting there alone, and she made me an offer I couldn't refuse. She informed me that I needed to tell the stories of the gods, guides, and ancestors. And in return, she gave me the name of the project, Knotwork. This would become a new realm where I could weave the stories that I loved and wanted more of. It was the place where I could meet so many myth-minded people, both my guests and my listeners. And there's an Irish phrase, fitte fuiche. It means interwoven. That's been true of the way that I've been able to weave together different voices and perspectives and stories and my own passion work with something that really feels like it serves the rest of the world. And this idea of interwoven, fitte fuiche, also describes the ways in which mythology and modernity are always intermingling with one another, having conversations with one another, strengthening each other by casting questions across time. We're not going back to the myths because we want to retreat to some pre-modern age. That would be impossible. But we are looking to understand where we are now, where we might be going. Okay, enough of these big picture pontifications and the personal reflections for now. Because talking about mythology in the abstract only takes us so far. We need the original material. We need the actors, the scenes, the symbols, the lands where the story took place to make the mythology into something living, breathing, and timeless all at once. Because, of course, these weren't just actors, plots, and scenes. There was something vital, enduring, and deeply true about them. So you've met Mungin. If you've listened to the show in the past, I've told a version that's very close to the quote-unquote original, or at least what we have in that compilation that O'Grady put together at the end of the 19th century. It's what I use for my source. And if Mungin's story is remembered at all these days, it tends to be remembered as the origin story of Nile of the Nine Hostages. Nile became the progenitor of the Enail dynasty, the family of the O'Neills. And they held power for centuries. You may have actually heard about this hypothesis that posited that millions of men living today could claim to be direct descendants of Nile. It's since been disproven, but it was one of those kind of fun blips in the whole genetic testing craze. And it certainly put Nile back on the map. But granted, Nile never really had any trouble with that. His name is easy to pronounce, and he lived a long and storied life. Because think about it. You and I and everyone we've ever met has met an O'Neill at some point in our lives. When I think about it now, even if I had known Mungin's story when I was birthing my own babies, I certainly would never have saddled American girls with such a name. As far as I know, no one has been asked to bear the name Mungin for centuries on either side of the Atlantic. And I'm assuming that, and I did a quick Google search, but in the searching out of Mungin's name, I often find links back to my own work. So if you have a granny or a niece with that fabulous, difficult to pronounce name, please introduce me. Because perhaps we could bring it back, but we'd need to work on the pronunciation. I've called her Mungfion in the past, simply because it sounded a little bit prettier, and I might slip back into that way of saying her name if I can get permission from a few more Gaelgors. But as her name is in the Old Irish, as I understand it, the pronunciation's a bit up for grabs. So I just invite you, if you have a white blonde-haired child, Mungin, Mungfion might be the perfect name. It also means white or sacred queen, according to another one of my primary sources for this work, Geród O'Cooley, who wrote the Book of the Cailleach. Either way, Mungin doesn't roll off the tongue the way Ruaidhri does. That name, by the way, it means Red King. Here's a moment for me to do a brief shout out to one of my oldest friends who embodies that name like no one else. My favorite, tallest, redhead. Ruaidhri, how you doing? Okay, I'm meandering again. You know, we talk about Samhain, about Halloween as being spooky season, but for me, I think it seems to be that it's spiraling, circuitous story season. Okay, I offered you a banshee and a witch who held court with women and the rabble after her untimely early November death. Let's go back to her. Mungin was a queen with four fine sons. Before that, we can imagine that she was the sovereignty goddess herself. Her husband, Yuki, was the rightful, honorable king, after all. We can only assume that he held his throne because he came by it in the old way. He met the sovereignty goddess. She found him worthy. She promised to be his bride and consort. And so, Mungin and Yuki took up the rulership at Tara, the traditional seat of the High Kings of Ireland. And all went on well enough until Yuki took a Saxon princess for a lover. And she, Karen, gave birth to a son named Niall. Okay, so I'm going to speed through the rest of the tale. And again, you can listen back to the past episodes. I'll link to those in the show notes. I'm going to ask you to meet me at the end, which is where, of course, we began today. After Yuki died, there was no clear successor to the throne. Niall was certainly a contender, but so were Mungin's boys, particularly the eldest, Brian. So Mungin asked her brother to play regent while her sons were away, training and building their kingly potential off in Scotland. When it was time for the boys to return home, and it was time for Crichan, Mungin's brother, to abdicate, he refused. Now, Mungin was a dedicated, passionate mother. Flawed, but decidedly dedicated and passionate. She had the kind of qualities that I believe would be celebrated or unremarked upon should a king have possessed them. She was single-minded. She had a vision for what was right. She was keeping the well-being of the kingdom and the land at the front of her mind. Now remember, she was born a sovereignty goddess. She was charged with keeping the balance between the realm of the gods, the Tuatha Dé Danann, and the land of men. Her husband's infidelity with a foreign princess, no less, that was a betrayal, not just of marriage vows, but of the sacred vows he had taken to the land of Éire herself. Mungin might be painted as a conniving mother who only was looking out for the advancement of her own brood, but she was a sacred queen who would have known in her very bones just who was the right sovereign for the land in that moment. It wasn't her brother, the power-hungry opportunist who overstayed his welcome. It was her son, Brian. And so she took the only last best option she had. She poured a cup of mead and added enough poison to kill a man 10 times over. Crichan, her canny brother, who wanted to hold on to that kingship, sat beside her at the great feast when they were welcoming the boys home from Scotland. She offered him the cup, and he said he would drink it, but only if she drank first. And so she did. She made the ultimate sacrifice, giving up her own life in order to take down the usurper who stood in front of her own son's fate, in front of what was best for the land itself. And then it worked. Then, on the eve of Samhain precisely, Mungin dies. So the queen is dead. The regent, her brother, Crihan, is dead. There's a leadership vacuum. The queen's sons, the king's illegitimate son, Niall. Eventually, Niall would rule all of Ireland, and Brian would become king of Connacht, and the other brothers would make history in their own way. But that's a story for another day. What I want to be, what we're here to explore today, is what happened next, outside the castle, far from the High King's seat. This is the death of Mungin the Banshee. Hence, Samhain is called by the rabble Mungin's Feast, for she was a witch and had magical power when she was in flesh. Wherefore, women and the rabble make petitions to her on Samhain. What happens to the common people when the powerful are negotiating behind closed doors, when they're battling amongst themselves for who will be in charge next? What happens to those who are neither warriors nor political operatives when there is no feminine principle anywhere near the throne? The women in the rabble are left to their petitions. Now, Samhain, it's the final harvest. It's a tremendous festival of fire before the long, dark winter sets in. This tradition was alive and well long before Mungin's time. But losing their queen at this liminal time, when the veils between the worlds and the scrim between death and life was so thin, must have been particularly potent. If the harvest had not been successful, if the storerooms were not full, the long winter would stretch on too long for many in the community. So when the women and the rabble gathered together to send their petitions to Mungin, they would have been thinking about their children's bellies as much, perhaps even more, than they were thinking about who would be in charge. Almost certainly they were thinking about that even more than they were thinking about the magical dance of spirit and soul and what might be possible when the veils between the worlds was thin. So these women and these rabble-rousers, these ordinary folk who would never sit at the high table, took to the edges of the world to remember their queen. Well, where do you think they gathered? I have been playing with this for weeks, and I still don't know. So I want to offer you a few options. We're going to do some myth work together. And then perhaps after you listen to the show, you can tell me what's come through for you. So imagine with me, where did they gather? Perhaps they built a great fire on the cliffs. In my imaginal realm, the cliff is the place of the outsiders. It's the space of horizons. It's a place for the edgewalkers. It's a place where you're seen by the sky, the sun, the stars, and all the elements, but you're far from the human eye. The castle loomed on a far, far hill. The village is nestled safely inland, but here, on the edge, this just might be the place for the women and the rabble to gather together and raise their voices. Or maybe they went beneath. Maybe they built their memorial fire in the belly of a cave, a well-ventilated cave, of course. The womb tomb of the cave. It's a place for mourning, for journeying, for rebirthing. When they have all settled in together, tight around a fire, in a confining space that held them safe, or would they have danced on the wildly open cliffside? Neither place, they could raise their prayers into screams and sing as loudly as they wanted. They could wail into the winds of the cliffs or trust the cave to hold their most ragged and raucous keen. Imagine that for a while. See what space feels most true to you. Maybe a third place emerges, something entirely new. And once you have a sense of that liminal space where this crowd gathers, let one or two come forth to whisper their stories to you. Me? I see a mother and a daughter, the first among equals in this band of mourners. Their power was not sanctioned by the Druid schools, but by their association with the queen, the sovereignty goddess herself. Neither servants nor peers of Mungin, these women walked the edges of royal society, offering their counsel, perhaps carrying secrets, but always creatures of the earth, of the old ways, attuned to the needs and wisdom of the other world, not the machinations of power and control. I see these women standing closest to the fire, but then drawing back to hold everyone from the outside edges, weaving in all the folk who've gathered, giving each one their space for their petitions so they could be crafted, spoken, heard. And then there's the third question. Where were they? Who was there? Well, what did these people pray for? They lived in a time of great uncertainty and fear. So very different and so very much like the times we live in now. What were they making their petitions for? Did they have a desire to touch some otherworldly magic? Were they praying for some sort of experience that would show them they lived in a world imbued with mystery, miracle, wonder? Those seem like prayers of the privileged. Were they more like the parents and children of Palestine or Sudan, sending their petitions to a departed divinity, asking that she might help them survive the winter, survive what might be a war? Could she help them keep the peace and improve the hunt? Once she might have been able to do so from the royal court at Tara, but could she do it now from across the sacred veil? Imagine them, call them in, hear their prayers, their wails, their keen, the crackling of their fires. Where do they gather? Who speaks to you? What do they weave into their petitions? As I said, I'm leaving this open-ended because I myself still don't know. The images all shift and flicker in the firelight. For now, it's a field of possibility, and I love being in that kind of uncertainty. Perhaps someday I will weave it into a narrative. Perhaps you'll help me. Perhaps you'll tell me what you see. I invite you to go over to mythismedicine.substack.com. I'll be posting an invitation to the women in the rabble, asking you for your visions, your projections, your petitions. When the sacred queen has died, when she's become a banshee and a witch, at least in the language of the storytellers and the recorders of the story, what do people do? So as we close, I want to name that for myself, I always want to be amongst the women and the rabble. I want to be with the sort of women who open their circles, not based on exclusive biological categories, but based on the deep connections between human hearts and minds, between those who deeply value the feminine. If you're interpreting that as me taking a stand against the surge of anti-trans rhetoric that I'm seeing from more and more self-proclaimed priestesses, who are claiming that to be in possession of a womb is the only way to commune with the sisters who honor the goddess, you heard me correctly. I want to be amongst the women who welcome in the rabble. And the rabble is a difficult thing, of course. The rabble doesn't have many positive connotations. There's a sense of discord, of noise, of perhaps feeling a trifle unsafe. But I think the rabble is something that we can reclaim and redefine. I think we can look to the rabble as being the ordinary folk who live close enough to the ground to hear her whispers, rather than being constantly beguiled by the songs coming from the halls of power. It's the rabble that gathers in the town square for the No Kings protests. It's the rabble that walks the streets of Dublin, raising voices in support of the people of Palestine. It's the rabble that will find ways to keep people fed, even as SNAP food assistance benefits run dry in the U.S. during this extended government shutdown. It's my prayer that the rabble will eventually be loud enough to take down the completely broken but working exactly as designed U.S. healthcare system that was designed to enrich corporations, not promote health or care for the people. All hail the women and the rabble who raise up their petitions in defense of the defenseless, who raise their petitions to offer care for those in their care. All hail the women and the rabble who are here for the work of wild reclamation, to be individuals forever knotted in the fate of the collective. We are indeed Fitchafuitcha, interwoven. And what happens on the Hill of Tara, what happens in the Capitol buildings across the country, across the world, that does influence us. But so does what happens when we put our feet on the ground, standing at a cliff at the edge of the world, seeking justice, seeking care, seeking a way to remember that we are all so very interconnected. All hail, Mungin. All hail the mythical queen. All hail, Mungin. All hail whatever deity it is who helps you reconnect to that which is most core, most important, the wisdom that emerges in the darkness, the wisdom that emerges in intimate conversations by the fireside, the wisdom that comes through when we raise up our voices to cry out, to keen, to call for justice. All hail, all hail, all hail. May your petitions be grounded, be heard, be answered, this Samhain tide and beyond.
Thank you for tuning in to Knot Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.